This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 4th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the U.S. House votes to make the estate tax permanent.
Those who've benefited the most from what our society has been able to create should be the ones who are responsible for contributing the most.
The British government continues its inquiry into the lead-up to the Iraq war.
My colleagues and I come to this task with open minds. We are apolitical, we are independent of any political party, and we want to examine and rely on the evidence.
And we'll go to the Gaza Strip, where the relief agency that provides services to more than a million residents faces financial collapse. Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. NATO says it will send 7,000 additional troops to Afghanistan to aid the U.S. in its planned troop surge.
If this international effort is to succeed, and it will, it must be a true team effort. The fact remains that what happens in Afghanistan has a direct effect on our own security.
NATO Chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen says the additional troops would come from 25 countries, but Germany and France were not among them. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton welcomed the pledge.
This is a crucial test for NATO. We are keenly aware that the members of this alliance have paid a steep price in lives and treasure.
Secretary General Rasmussen also pledged that more troop support would come. Anti-war activists in the United States have been protesting Obama's surge announcement all week. On Thursday, Guinean President Moussa Dadis Camara was shot by his own aide at a military base. The president and one of his ministers have been evacuated to Morocco for medical treatment. Businesses remain closed and security is tight in the capital city. This comes as the country recovers from violently suppressed protests and looks ahead to national elections. Community News Production Institute member and FSRN reporter Abdoulaye Ba has more from Conakry.
Captain Moussa Dadis Camara has escaped an assassination attempt from one of his closest aides, Abubakar Siddiqui Jakite, also known as Tumba. The incident took place yesterday evening at a downtown military base. According to the government, the president suffered a non-life-threatening injury. One of his ministers was also injured, and two unidentified people have been confirmed dead. Despite what many here view as a growing tension within the army, Communication Minister Idrissa Sherif says there's no reason to panic.
Keep in mind that the president is doing well. This morning he had breakfast and met with his military aides. I think everything is okay. The current situation in Guinea is under control, including the interior of the country. Everything is okay.
Despite these assurances, the president was medically evacuated to Morocco without any formal request addressed to the Moroccan government. The assassination attempt follows last September's killings of over 150 civilians who had gathered at the National Stadium to express their support for opposition leaders. A UN-backed mission is currently in the capital to investigate the rape and killing that many here believe were orchestrated by the junta leaders, including the shooter. As of Friday, Tumba has not been arrested. No word yet if January's scheduled national elections will go forward as planned. For FSRN, I'm Abdoulaye Ba in Conakry, Guinea.
Mexico City police have busted a massive human trafficking operation, freeing more than 100 slaves and arresting 25 alleged perpetrators. From Mexico, Shannon Young has more.
The facade of a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center hid a clandestine factory where 107 men and women were forced to work 16 hours a day without pay, making handbags and clothespins. They were housed behind bars in overcrowded dorms with prison-style triple bunk beds and metal latrines. Some were addicts whose families had checked them in for rehabilitation support, but the vast majority of those rescued had been abducted off the streets surrounding Mexico City's massive Central de Abasto food market. Police patrolling the Central Market area allegedly participated in abductions. The victims are primarily indigenous men from rural areas, and several do not speak Spanish. Many of the rescued have been hospitalized for severe malnutrition, dehydration, skin infections, and injuries. Records show that the rehabilitation center has been in operation for more than 8 years. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
Following up on a story from yesterday, after the U.S. Supreme Court denied a final appeal, Texas executed Bobby Wayne Woods last night. Woods' IQ was low enough that many questioned whether the sentence violated a Supreme Court ruling against executing people with mental retardation. And finally, some promising news from the Labor Department today. The jobless rate in the U.S. declined in November from 10.2% to an even 10%, and the number of jobs lost plummeted from 111,000 in October to 11,000 in November. These are the best job loss numbers since the recession began in 2007. The alternate unemployment rate, that includes part-time workers who want to be full-time and those who have given up looking for work, remains high but is coming down as well. But still, 17.2% of the civilian workforce falls into this category. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Doreen Marina in New York. In the Gaza Strip, the main service provider is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA. This week, the agency announced it is on the brink of financial collapse. That could mean serious problems for the more than 1 million people who receive food, health, and other services from the agency. FSRN's Rami Amlagari has more.
United Nations officials described the situation as dire, saying they are facing the worst financial crisis in the agency's 60-year history. UNRWA spokesperson Adnan Abu Hasna says they will reach a zero-sum budget by the end of the year.
The situation is unprecedented and absolutely unbearable. And that's what we conveyed at the meeting of donor and host countries in Amman in November of this year. It was clear enough that we cannot continue providing services to more than 4.7 million Palestinian refugees in the Middle East amidst such large-scale deterioration.
The United Nations established the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Since then, it has provided services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and in the occupied territories. In Gaza, UNRWA provides food, education, health, and job programs to more than 1 million people. The services are essential as Gazans face a 2.5-year-long Israeli and Egyptian blockade of the border closings. The blockade has contributed to massive unemployment, almost 70% of Gaza's labor force, according to local and international estimates. Outside UNRWA's headquarters in Gaza City, several university graduates line up. Like so many here, they are unemployed and came seeking job opportunities by UNRWA. Muhammad Juma graduated with a math degree a year ago.
Of course, I appeal to donor countries to help UNRWA because UNRWA helps us earn a living. UNRWA is worth helping so that it can help the people earn a living through the job creation programs.
In October of this year, UNRWA expanded its job creation program, providing temporary job opportunities to an estimated 14,000 people. More than 3,000 of those jobs were dedicated to supporting the Palestinian private sector, which is struggling to survive. UNRWA's budget is around $600 million. The agency is funded through voluntary contributions from donor countries. The largest contributions come from the US, European Union, UK, and Sweden. In response to the crisis this week, 19 donors pledged more than $90 million, but officials say they still expect a large budget shortfall and cuts to programs and services. The agency currently has no money in its reserves. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Human rights officials are raising concerns about continued attacks on civilians in Darfur, Sudan. Since 2003, some 2 million have been displaced and hundreds of thousands killed. Many say the conflict was directly supported by the government in Khartoum, and the massacre of civilians has been called a genocide, including by the U.S. government. Luis Moreno Ocampo is prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. He says they have evidence of new human rights violations.
Crimes are continuing. There are still indiscriminate bombings of civilians, causing casualties and forced displacement during the last 6 months. Continued imposition of conditions of life to exterminate displaced persons in the camps, including hindering of humanitarian assistance and expelling of the assistance providers, with the obvious consequence of reducing access to food, water, and services. There are continuing rapes and sexual violence, constituting mental and bodily harm, and it continues the use of child soldiers by different parties. As recently as last week, on 25 November, there were reports of militia Janjaweed attacks against Al-Hurra and Jabed Issa, two villages in North Darfur, in which civilians were captured, villagers beaten, and property looted.
The International Criminal Court has been trying to bring Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir to court since March, when the ICC issued an arrest warrant for him and two other officials. Ocampo said President al-Bashir has refused to appear in court and has refused to appoint a lawyer to represent his position.
President al-Bashir will face justice. Any leader committing this type of crimes will face justice. Power does not provide immunity. There was no immunity for President Milosevic. There was no immunity for Prime Minister Kambanda. There was no immunity for President Taylor.
Meanwhile, some officials say the Obama administration isn't doing enough to improve the situation in Darfur. A former UN investigator testified to Congress yesterday that the U.S., France, and Britain have not sufficiently enforced sanctions or evaluated the impact of an arms embargo on the country. Enrico Carrish also blasted the entire UN Security Council for dismissing an estimated 100 recommendations to strengthen the sanctions against Khartoum. This is Doreen Marina in New York City. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Stay with us. The British government continues its inquiry into its role in the Iraq War. The inquiry, which began last week, showed that senior diplomats had doubts about the legality of the war. This week, Tony Blair's former foreign policy adviser, Sir David Manning, testified. Panel members asked about the controversial Crawford Ranch meeting, during which some speculate former U.S. President George W. Bush convinced Blair to support an invasion of Iraq regardless of whether weapons of mass destruction were discovered. FSRN's George Lavender reports.
The five-person committee of inquiry, selected by Prime Minister Gordon Brown, is chaired by Sir John Chilcot, a career civil servant.
My colleagues and I come to this task with open minds. We are apolitical, we are independent of any political party, and we want to examine and rely on the evidence.
Despite assurances that the inquiry is impartial, the committee includes prominent supporters of the war. Among them is Sir Lawrence Friedman, a former foreign policy adviser to Tony Blair. Nadia Mahmoud is an Iraqi political activist in the south of the country.
I watch the news on Iraqi TV channel satellite. It's inquiry that comes from the establishment. It's not outsiders who want to do this inquiry. Iraqi people don't put a lot of hope on the results. In a small room near the House of Parliament, the panel heard evidence last week from senior government officials and diplomats that regime change in Iraq was supported by many in Washington, even before 2001.
In a small room near the Houses of Parliament, the panel heard evidence last week from senior government officials and diplomats that regime change in Iraq was supported by many in Washington, even before 2001.
There is more of a continuum here with previous administrations before George W. than maybe the Democratic Party and the Republican Party would be willing to admit.
Former ambassador to the United States, Sir Christopher Mayer, testified on the third day of hearings.
So sometimes people say to me, well, you know, it was the nutters in the administration, the right-wingers, the neocons, who invented regime change. Absolutely wrong.
The panel asked Mayer when the British government became committed to the policy of regime change. He speculated that Tony Blair and George W. Bush reached an agreement on taking military action almost a year before the war started.
To this day, I'm not entirely clear what degree of convergence was, if you like, signed in blood at the Crawford Ranch.
For many anti-war activists, the inquiry lacks credibility. Witnesses may be offered immunity from prosecution in exchange for testimony, and are not under oath. In setting up the inquiry, Gordon Brown also made it clear it would not apportion blame. For many Iraqis, the inquiry is inconsequential. Again, Najim Mahmood.
I think that what the Iraqi people are really concerned about is not what the Iraq inquiry is going to find out. They are really concerned about their daily life, about security, about their jobs. It is chaos here. It is a mess here. And people really care about these things.
Violence has increased in the country in advance of government elections. Last month, more than 155 people were killed in two car bombings in Baghdad, in the deadliest attack since 2007. The panel will also hear from both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. It's expected to publish a final report at the end of 2010. George Lavender, FSRN, London.
While attention this week has focused on President Obama's plan to increase troops in Afghanistan, another military operation that the government says is key to success in the region continues. That's the controversial use of drone attacks in Pakistan. The New York Times reports that the White House has authorized an expansion of the Central Intelligence Agency's drone program in Pakistan. The program started during the Bush administration and has continued after Obama took over the presidency. It uses unmanned aircrafts, often controlled by pilots stationed in the U.S., to locate and kill targets. The Times quotes an anonymous government official who says that about 80 missile attacks from drones in less than 2 years have killed more than 400 militants. But human rights groups have criticized the practice. According to the BBC, hundreds of civilians have been killed in the attacks in the past few years, and the use of drones has been highly controversial within Pakistan. Dr. Saida Iqbal is a senator with the Pakistan People's Party. She says the news that drones will continue to be used by the U.S. has tapped into a broader fear that Pakistan could see an escalation of the conflict. FSRN spoke to her earlier today via cell phone.
People have a fear. People have a syndrome of fear. They feel that Pakistan is going to be next. First it was Iraq and then it was Afghanistan and now it's going to be Pakistan.
This week, Pakistan's prime minister announced that Osama bin Laden was not in the country. This came in response to UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown's calls for the country to do more to find bin Laden. But Senator Iqbal says that she would like to see the U.S. contribute more in the next phase of the effort.
Still, Pakistan is bearing the burden and Pakistan is being told to do more. In fact, it is the Americans and our friends in Europe and the rest of the world who should do more for Pakistan.
Iqbal says she is not against the use of the drone technology, but would like to see the Pakistani military take a larger role in the strategy in order to reduce civilian casualties. Perhaps no issue gets to the heart of class privilege quite like the estate tax. Republicans call it a death tax, but progressives say it makes sense to charge large inheritances in order to keep wealthy families from passing their wealth along to generation after generation. The House voted Thursday to make the tax permanent. But as FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports, no one seems happy with the result.
It's one of those Washington compromises that doesn't really satisfy anyone. Conservatives have been out to abolish the estate tax for years, so they're not excited about this move to make it permanent. And liberals think the tax should be higher and should apply to more people. The current tax, which the House voted to freeze in place permanently, only taxes estates over $3.5 million, or $7 million for a couple, and then it's taxed at a rate of 45%. But progressives say the important thing is just to have the tax in place.
The estate tax really is the fairest tax. It's the only tax on inherited wealth that our country has, and we should make sure it stays strong and robust.
Chuck Collins is co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, a network of wealthy people supporting equitable taxation. He and Bill Gates Sr. co-authored Wealth and Our Commonwealth, Why America Should Tax Accumulated Fortunes.
It slows down the concentration of wealth. And the concentration of wealth is power. And so if we want to keep our country from becoming more and more of a plutocracy, aristocracy, which we already are drifting seriously that way, the estate tax is one of the ways we stop that.
One member of Collins' network of rich folks is Eric Schoenberg.
My father was a very successful entrepreneur. So my parents, they're divorced, but they would both be independently subject to the estate tax. Before moving to academia, I myself was a partner in an investment bank, and I had a sufficiently successful career that even on my own, I'd be subject to the estate tax. So there's nothing that would save me more money than elimination of the estate tax.
Yet he, along with big-name billionaires like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, adamantly opposes its elimination.
Those who've benefited the most from what our society has been able to create should be the ones who are responsible for contributing the most.
But in 2001, as part of President Bush's tax plan, Congress passed a law gradually phasing out the estate tax until 2010, when it was to be eliminated altogether, but only for 1 year. Republicans at the time were hoping that by 2010 they'd have the votes to abolish the tax permanently, but things haven't entirely gone their way. Curtis Dubé is senior tax policy analyst at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
So what the House did yesterday is essentially a massive tax hike for many families, and especially family-owned businesses that will be hit hard by the death tax in years to come.
Some say estate tax opponents are still getting a pretty good deal. Chuck Maher of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Right now, one in every 500 estates pays the estate tax. So therefore, any cut that is made, right, any reduction flows to that, you know, again, one in 500 of the states.
If Congress didn't do anything, Bush's law would stand, and 2010 would be a great year for rich people to die. But in 2011, it would revert back to the 2002 estate tax, which is far more progressive than what the House just passed. That estate tax would apply to inheritances of $1 million and up, as opposed to the new House bill, which only applies once you stand to inherit $3.5 million. And the 2002 version taxes the inheritance at 50%, not 45%. So that's what the House just voted not to allow. Instead, it froze this year's tax rate, which was as generous as the Bush tax cuts got, short of the ultimate goal of abolition. The Senate still has to vote on its version of the bill, which is a good deal more generous for the wealthy than even the House bill. The Senate version would raise the exemption for individuals to $5 million, $10 million for couples, and lower the tax rate to 35%. If Chuck Maher isn't a huge fan of the House proposal, he's even less excited about the Senate idea.
Those proposals actually would only affect 0.2% of the entire population. So it's really a very large tax cut, again, to a very, very small slice of the population.
Because of the focus on health care, the Senate may not take up the estate tax in time for the December 31st deadline, which would make 2010 a jubilee year for the rich. But they could pass a one-year extension, kicking the can down the road till they can consider it more fully. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
And now we go to California, where a nun has been holding a fast on the campus of UC Berkeley for the return of Native American remains. The university has the remains of around 12,000 Native Americans stored underneath the school's pool in the gymnasium. Federal law requires the return of such remains to tribes that request them, but as Africa Jones reports, there are loopholes.
Outside UC Berkeley's Phoebe Hearst Museum of Anthropology, Jun Yasuda has been holding a vigil and fasting for the last 5 days. The Buddhist nun from Japan says the remains of thousands of Native Americans do not belong to the museum.
So Roni people has been requested to return to back to the land because they're just putting cardboard. And who comfortable, you know, if think about ancestor people's bone, putting all time cardboard, if you respect ancestor people.
Although federal law requires the museum to identify the tribal origins of the remains and return them to tribes who request them, there's a loophole. The tribe must be recognized by the federal government. And although the origin of many of the bones is known, the museum says that 80% of the remains are unaffiliated or do not belong to federally recognized tribes. Karina Gould belongs to the Chichino Olani tribe.
The Native American Graves and Repatriation Act went into effect in 1990, and basically the law works specifically with federally recognized tribes in order to give back their ancestral remains. At this time, Ohlone tribe is not federally or state recognized.
The Ohlone are the indigenous inhabitants of the San Francisco Bay Area and have asked the Bureau of Indian Affairs for recognition. Burial sites called shell mounds used to dot the Bay Area landscape, numbering in the hundreds, some as high as three-story buildings. Karina Gould says as the land was developed, the sites and remains were desecrated.
Cemeteries are sacred to all cultures, and what I like to tell people usually is that most of my recent relatives are buried at St. Mary's Cemetery in Oakland, and we wouldn't think about putting a Dunkin' Donuts or a Gap or a Barnes & Noble on top of them. You can go to other countries and you can see the remains of their ancestral structures and touch the pyramids in Egypt. You can go and touch Stonehenge. But when you come to the Bay Area, what is it that you see of my ancestors that remains here? Malls, and we get to see parking lots, and we don't even see parks.
Gould says activists have a meeting scheduled with museum officials next week. UC Berkeley did not respond to calls for comment by airtime. Africa Jones, FSRN Berkeley.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Tanya Snyder. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.